Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another episode of Not in a Creepy Way, the podcast where the brothers Anderson will dig deep into the movies. The brothers Anderson are. This is Eric, he's the oldest one. The producer who makes it fun, gotta give him the credit. He's good with the edits. He's been the driving force since they begun. Next we got brother Jay. He just the movies that they play. The sip in the middle, Jay is gonna be a little more critical, analytical when he communicates. And lastly we got Drew, the finally family member of this group. He decides if the movie's worth it. Right kind of guy, that's for certain. Three chatty brothers with a family base. Need an excuse to talk away. Dichotomy of personalities. All you really need to do is press play. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you want to catch an episode. They talk movies till they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's the brothers Anderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open to that case. We got Eric, Drew, and brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way.
Hey. Welcome, this is Eric.
This is Drew.
And tonight we're going to talk about the 1995 submarine film Crimson Tide. Directed by Tony Scott and produced by Don Simpson and Jerry Bruckheimer.
I've been waiting for a long time for this one to come out.
Excellent. So actually, just take it away. Tell us, guide us into Crimson Tide.
You know, my memory of this movie is that we saw it in the theater together. That may not exactly jive with when it came out. I don't know what your memory is.
Yeah, no, it seems like we would have seen it in the theater.
Yeah, so it would have been the first summer I came back from college.
And it was released in May.
Yeah, it was released in May. It's entirely possible that I came back and we saw it in late May or early June.
Yeah, that would make sense. I was still in training. No, I didn't get the job. I hadn't even applied for the job yet, I don't think. I was footloose and fancy free. Working 6 a.m. to 2 p.m., I think.
Ah, oh, what an awesome shift.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, this movie at the time was chock full of star power. You had Gene Hackman, who was, you know, still a top billing actor, Denzel Washington, and a pre 9/11 military movie, which was, you know, way more, as you put it, way more fun and fancy free.
Yeah, and also, there's strange echoes that resonate today when I watched it earlier this week.
There really are.
And just to jump in, I love, I can't say I love submarine movies necessarily, but the thing with the submarine movie is you can forgive a lot of technology stuff because they're on a submarine, you know?
Yeah.
So, it's great. It's, and they didn't dwell. Like, The Hunt for Red October sort of had, like, a kind of fetishized the submarine.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not quite that. It told you enough, but it didn't tell you too much.
You're right. A submarine movie is sort of innately compelling. I'm not sure why. I can't really articulate why. Maybe it's the added tension from being in such an enclosed environment. There's sort of that just general sense of dread you have of being completely underwater. Because anytime anything goes wrong, it is a life-threatening situation, no matter what. And all of that adds, it just ratchets up tension. Which is a great setting for what is already like a top-notch thriller.
Yeah, the plot is great. It's very simple.
It's simple, but it's not simplistic.
No. And it's actually based loosely on something real.
Oh, I don't want to think about that.
Oh, I'll tell you.
That's actually pretty terrifying.
And there are so many actors that now are just wonderful, fresh, young faces that we know and love and in some case mourn.
And there's definitely a protagonist and an antagonist in this movie, but there are no real villains, except maybe for James Gandolfini.
Yeah. Because we'll get into the plot, but everybody's got a point. Like the two main characters each of them have a point. Each of them are right.
Yes.
And the fate of the world relied on how that last act ended up.
Yeah, that's why, like you said, it's a simple, it's a straightforward plot, but it is very, very nuanced and has a lot of depth to it.
Yeah. And have we seen a bad Gene Hackman movie ever? Have we talked about it, let's say? Surely there must be a bad Gene Hackman movie.
Welcome to Mooseport.
I'd have to revisit that. I would contend that's a bad Ray Romano movie, but he was even good in, like, Heartbreakers.
Oh, yeah. So, has there ever been a bad Gene Hackman performance is different than has he ever been in a bad movie?
True. Yeah, you're right. He's Michael Caine. He makes everything better. We've probably already said that phrase about him.
Oh, I'm sure we have.
Because it's just true. And, you know, we talk a lot. I mean, I think you first shone the light on it. But we talk a lot about how Tom Cruise is just so compelling. He's a movie star. Like, he's not always the best actor in the film, but he is the star. He just commands your attention. Well, that Denzel Washington also has that.
So does Gene Hackman.
Oh, true. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. It's a great pairing.
Yeah. And then, and again, lots of fun supporting actors like Viggo Mortensen and James Gandolfini.
Mm-hmm.
And it's this is the first movie that
Ricky Schroeder.
Yeah, and Ryan Philippe.
I say Philippe. I'm not sure who's right.
No, you're right. It's Philippe. Hate that guy. But just because his character is unlikable in Cruel Intentions. Turns out all the characters in that movie are unlikable.
Did you already say Viggo Mortensen?
Yes. A very young Viggo Mortensen.
He's great. He has a really small part, but I love it. And he does such a great job.
Yeah.
There's another actor from The Sopranos who plays the radio repairman.
Yes.
Who ended up doing time for, I think, attempted murder or something.
Oh, no. Or sorry, if I was in Ireland. Oh, no.
Nicely done.
Yeah, there you go. Attempted murder.
And there's the Silver Surfer dude who's one of those guys.
Yeah. Well, okay. Here's another thing about this movie that I had forgotten, but became apparent when I started watching it. This is a movie that got punched up by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, that really shines through in some of the parts.
From the very beginning when they talk about the submarine movies, you're like, oh, hold on. But it works. It's great.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, the conversations, you know, between the submarine movies and the Lipizzan or Stallions or whatever.
Yep, that really felt like a Tarantino scene.
Especially the end, the button on it by Gene Hackman. Mm-hmm. I was like, just, you know, it doesn't always have to go to 11, Quentin. Got to distract him by foot pictures or whatever. So, sorry, I shouldn't yuck anybody's yums. Shall we get into the plot?
Yes, we should.
I just want something else to talk about because otherwise I'm just going to gush about this movie. So, again, the plot is fairly simple. We are post-Soviet Russia, and civil war erupts as a result of the ongoing conflict in Chechnya. And all of this is just done on, you see it on TV.
Mm-hmm.
And military units loyal to Vladimir Radchenko, a Russian ultranationalist, take control of a nuclear missile installation and are threatening nuclear war if either the American or the Russian governments attempt to confront him.
This is probably the only thing that took me out of the movie is Radchenko. That actor, I don't know his name, but he had hilariously goofy roles on both Seinfeld and Malcolm in the Middle. So seeing him as like the menacing ultra nationalist boogeyman in this movie was a little jarring.
Yeah. He was, his name is Daniel Van Bargen, and he was Mr. Kruger in Seinfeld and Commandant Edward Spangler on Malcolm in the Middle.
Did you ever watch Malcolm in the Middle?
I did.
Yeah, do you remember Spangler?
Was it when one of the kids went off to the military?
Yeah,
Yeah.
He had a hook. And maybe an eye patch? I forget.
I had also forgotten Steve Zahn's in this movie.
Oh, yeah. He does not have a great time.
No, he doesn't. So, the U.S. Navy nuclear submarine, USS Alabama. By the way, that's why the movie's called Crimson Tide. I may have actually not put that together until I watched this movie again.
Yeah, look, we don't live in that part of the country.
Well, now I'm married into that part of the country. So I've never been there, but now I get all the Roll Tide comments.
Yeah.
So, the USS Alabama is assigned to a patrol mission to be available to launch its missiles in a preemptive strike if Rodchenko attempts to fuel his missiles. So we have a ticking time bomb here. They will get, 1 hour notice. And the idea is once the missiles get fueled and launched, then it's already over. So there has to be a preemptive strike.
Yeah. And Rodchenko had control of a naval base, right? So he had 4 subs and missiles, but not the access codes.
Exactly. At first.
Mm-hmm.
So we first meet actually Vigo and Denzel at a birthday party for Denzel's daughter.
Yes.
They get called away to this mission. And so Denzel and Vigo know each other from the Navy, of course. But Denzel's character is he is an executive officer, lieutenant commander. So XO, as they refer to him, second in command. But he is a new XO assigned to this submarine because the other guy has a mono or something, some disease.
Appendicitis,
there we go. So he's second in command in this new boat. New to him boat. An old boat. I don't know, maybe do they call it a ship? It's not a boat, right? Ships, boats. Boats can go on top of ships, something like that. So Gene Hackman is the commander of this craft, and he is a grizzled old what is his he's a commander, but is he like
captain?
Yeah, and he's got a dog, a little yippy dog.
Oh, before we even get there, I actually really loved the birthday scene in a way I don't remember, and maybe it's just being older and being at a different stage in my life, but I found it really impactful of, watching these guys who are in the Navy, on their time off, watching the news. And they don't ever this is not overt. They don't ever talk about it, but it's definitely there. It's a weird thing to wrap your head around the fact that when you're watching major worldwide news events, that actually might impact your job and what you have to do. So I appreciated that little scene of Vigo and Denzel watching the news, understanding that they may have to go do something about this.
Yeah, because actually Denzel's camera runs out of batteries just as the magician is starting his act. So he has to go run and swap out the battery. But the TV is on in the other room with CNN or whatever, and they're having live coverage of this civil war. And Vigo comes after him to say, what is taking him so long? You're going to miss the whole trick or whatever. And then they both are sucked into the TV saying, uh-oh.
Yeah. And then they both get paged, right? Beepers?
Yeah. Yep, they have beepers. Yep. Immediately.
I miss you, mid-90s.
Yes. So they get out and they're going to do a patrol. And they have missiles, so they can fire them off. But they're just kind of headed into the area. They will get orders en route or whatever. And there's an interesting tension brews between Captain Ramsey is Gene Hackman and XO Hunter is Washington. And the XO is a by the book guy, but he's also a Harvard guy. He's a college guy. He's not he didn't see any action. Captain Ramsey has actually, he's the only one who's seen action of all of them.
Yeah, he is the last surviving submarine captain who's actually seen combat.
And is a wise old guy.
Mm-hmm.
And is actually quite flattering. to and charming to Ramsey at first, or sorry, to Hunter at first.
Yeah, I don't know. He was another thing that struck me watching the movie this time around. Ramsey really is an asshole from the very beginning. Even during his initial interview, when he starts talking about high school girls. Again, when I watched this as a 19-year-old, that I think that part didn't skeeve me out quite so much. But now watching it now, I'm like, oh, okay, yeah. This guy's a grade A asshole from the very beginning.
I wonder how, because it's a culture thing too. Mm-hmm. I wonder how much of this locker room talk still happens. It must. It's got to. I think it's just part of the culture.
Well, and the way Gene Hackman plays it, it's not just like locker room talk to be one of the guys. It's really calculating to see how Hunter reacts.
Exactly.
And that makes it not just feel a little inappropriate, but also adds like menace to it, even though it's seemingly a friendly conversation. He's trying to dominate and take control already.
Yes. Well, he's the captain.
Mm-hmm.
So we get some gratuitous shots of the Alabama. Did you see any of how they got the shots of the Alabama, of the actual Alabama submerging?
No. So not when they're all standing out in the rain, but when it's actually
like hitting the waves and going down.
Yeah, I mean it was very obvious that it was not the same. It was not one shot.
Oh no.
Of when they were standing in the I don't even know what you call the open cockpit thing that they're standing on, having the cigar before they go down and submerge.
Yes.
But yeah, so the close up didn't really match the wide shot.
Well, see, it's like a... No, never mind. I won't even try it. I had a guess, but I'm not going
to
guess.
Are you trying to look up submarine parts?
Nah, I think it's like the conning tower or something, but I don't know. Anyway, so I'm not worried about it. Yeah, what happened was... So first of all, Tony Scott got a lot of cooperation to film Top Gun. So he figured, hey, I'll get a lot of cooperation to film Crimson Tide, right? Also about the Navy. Unfortunately, with Top Gun, it's all rah, rah, rah. It was just an ad to be a Navy pilot. But Crimson Tide is about mutiny on an American nuclear submarine. So, yeah, there was a lot less cooperation and free movement. I mean, they got to be aboard a sub during the an exercise, like a launch exercise, which is how they got the details of that right. Apparently the captain of that boat or the chief of the boat or whoever on that submarine may have been the one to like give them the ideas about how the mutiny was going to work. Because I think the initial script was the onboard computer was going to have it automatically send the missiles. So it was going to be a man versus computer. And he's like, oh, it's much, much better if it's a mutiny.
Yeah.
Like, oh, well, perfect. So anyway, so they got to do that, but they didn't, of course, want a lot of filming of actual subs and stuff. So they went to Hawaii where they were having some sort of exercise and they rented some helicopters and went out looking for subs and they found the Alabama and the Alabama's like, leave us alone. But they were in open airspace, so they couldn't do anything about it. So instead, they just submerged, which was like exactly the shot they wanted to get anyway.
Oh, that's funny. So they just kind of lucked into it?
Yeah, exactly. So I think that's pretty fun. But the rest of it is, shot on a soundstage with the whole set on a gimbal that can, move to the different planes as the boat is sinking or submerging or emerging. Which is good. In a submarine movie, you have to have slanty stuff. Just like in like the Starship mm-hmm. Enterprise, you have to go back and forth.
Right.
So we have this. The first thing we see is an exercise where we see the emergency action. The emergency action message, which is kind of a fun little system. So they have this. They get this message that comes in. It's all printed out and it's got a code in it. and then it has to, the code has to be verified, and it's all very specific because, you know, of course, you're launching nuclear weapons, so you want things to be crystal clear. And then it takes two people to launch the missiles. It takes the captain and the XO. And actually, the weapons controller officer, too, he has to be involved in it. It's all very complicated and involved. But the first bit of tension is there was a fire in the galley. The fire, it was actually a fairly significant event. And right after the fire, or as the fire was still, you know, was being put out, the captain decided to do the drill.
Yes.
And Hunter is none too pleased about this because he just helped avert the ship from sinking. And we have injured crew members.
And he was worried that the fire could flare back up at any moment.
Exactly. So he disagreed with the timing of it. But, you know, the captain's the captain.
Yeah. And again, a dick move, but the captain had a point.
Yeah. Yeah. You got to be ready.
Mm-hmm.
It's not going to happen when it's convenient to you. So yeah. It makes sense.
Yeah. So already they're setting up a scenario where both XO Hunter and Captain Ramsey have legitimate points of view.
Yes. And also there's a nice little conversation where Ramsey says, you do not contradict me in front of other soldiers, sailors, sorry. Like basically, you agree with me or you take me aside. And if there's not an opportunity to take me aside, you shut the fuck up. Mm-hmm. He's like, okay, message received. So that's when the real tension starts, is we learn that things are ramping up, and they get a couple of these messages saying that they start out as DEFCON 4 and go up to like DEFCON 2, where DEFCON 1 would be full nuclear war.
Mm-hmm.
But things are ratcheting up, and they learn that Rodchenko now probably has the codes. And so
I think they mentioned that the last time they went to DEFCON 3 was the Cuban Missile Crisis.
Exactly, yes. Which, by the way, I think that's when this event that really happened, by the way, it happened to a Russian ship, Russian submarine. That's when it happened.
Oh, we skipped over a philosophical discussion early on that like the officers have in the officers' mess hall, where we find that Hunter is, relatively speaking, he's pretty liberally minded.
Yes.
Which ruffles Ramsey a little bit. He makes a statement to the effect of, when you're dealing with nuclear weapons, the real enemy is war itself. And Ramsey is not really, he's not predisposed to see things in those shades of gray. He's much more black and white, good guys and bad guys.
Also, we find out that, again, it's a Tarantino thing, but it's a great little piece of tension or conflict, the whole, or not really conflict, it's just a big, good piece of business, where they have the Silver Surfer conversation, where two sailors get into a fight in the mess hall, and it turns out a physical fight, and turns out the cause of the fight was an argument whether Jack Kirby's Silver Surfer was... The superior Silver Surfer, or who's the other guy?
Mobius.
Mobius, yes. Oh, from Yudorowski's Dune, right?
Sounds right.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah. So whether the Mobius Silver Surfer was whatever. And so Hunter diffuses the situation by saying, look, you know, people look up to you. You have whatever slight rank or whatever. So you still have to be in control. And quite obviously, Kirby Silver Surfer is the only Silver Surfer. So it's great. And he also doesn't discipline the guys either, because they're tense, because, you know, they read the news too. And, you know, they know they're going out to potentially launch nuclear weapons.
Yep.
But the captain's like, I don't care how they feel. They're tense. Good. Oh, and of course, he also patronizes Hunter over the intercom in the whole ship. Where he talks about how XO Hunter says, you guys are under stress, I understand that. But anybody who's under too much stress can get off the boat now. Suck it up, you want a cookie?
If Gene Hackman didn't have such natural charisma, Ramsay really would have been just like an over the top monster.
Yeah. Well, and there is a monstrous turn later, but so far he's just an asshole. But again, it's not a, what is the phrase is, they are there to protect the democracy. They're not there to engage in democracy.
Yes.
This is a military organization. There is leadership and there are orders and they will be followed. So we have an emergency action message that actually orders the launch of 10 missiles at the nuclear installation because there's satellite information that the missiles are being fueled. And they have already spotted, or they are soon to spot, another sub in the water. This is off the Kamchatka Peninsula or whatever, which we know partly because Alaska is next to Kamchatka and partly because if you've played Risk, that's a strategic point on the map.
It's very important.
Yes. So they end up having to dive to avoid being detected by this Russian sub. And it's the class of sub that is all, it makes it possible that it's actually one of Rodchenko's subs.
Yes. The Akula class sub?
Yes.
Which doesn't sound like a real thing, but I hope it is.
Actually, it is.
Good.
Yeah, I did a little research. It's not the actual sub in question. It wouldn't be that class of sub. But NATO does have a classification of Russian Akula class subs. Anyway, so they have to, you know, run silent, run deep to avoid detection by the Russian sub. So they don't have like an actual, like, whatever the sub equivalent of a dogfight is underwater. And also, unfortunately, when they dive super deep, they can't get any radio transmissions. An important point.
Yeah, which is a problem because they start to get one.
Yeah, they start to get one, but it's also during an attack by the sub, and the electronics are damaged, and they can't decode the second message. So a second message comes in, and so the rest of this whole movie is based on whether that second message was cancel, like return to DEFCON 4 or whatever, or launch, launch, launch. Because the order, the last order, the last verified order was launch 10 missiles.
Mm-hmm.
And so they are loading up to launch 10 missiles. They have to get to a certain depth to do that. Like 150 feet or something. And they have dived to much deeper. First to avoid the Russian sub, and then when they end up having that little sub-to-sub fight and they are damaged, they, of course, go to near crush depth, which is a scary possibility. Either everybody dies or you'll be fine. But this isn't a movie about the crushing of the Crimson Tide or the Alabama or whatever.
What would be worse? Drowning in a compromised submarine or being crushed to death in an imploding submarine because you're too great at pressure?
Well, you know who knows? Russian submariners. Because both things have happened. I think there have been two U.S. subs that I could find that actually had like sunk and basically because of crush depth. But I think one of them was already like to be salvaged or something anyway. It wasn't like an active duty warship. And I can't remember what the other one was. But there was definitely a Russian sub that that sank relatively recently. And they didn't ask for help because they were off the coast of Norway, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't ask for help for like 7 days. And it turns out, and they said, you know, well, it was a fire or something aboard the submarine and everybody died and it was all very sad, but we have to salvage right away. So they did. Well, turns out, no, the crew had like locked themselves in a compartment that wasn't flooded. And then over the next however many days died. So that would have been rough.
Yes.
Yeah, that's the other thing is also subs are secret, so you can't, you know, you can't say, hey, everybody help. At least you're not supposed to. And also, you don't want to give away your technology. And maybe your actual, I don't know, nuclear material and weapons to the enemy.
Right.
So, you know, or to a hostile power, depending on how hot your war is. So, yeah, so the rest of the tension is Hunter thinks there's a chance that this message was cancel the launch. And Ramsay is like, we don't know what this message is, and it doesn't matter because the last message we got was to launch the missiles, so we are going to launch the missiles. Period. Because, and in both of their cases, like if Hunter is right, then if they launch the missiles, it's the end of the world because everybody's missiles are going to fly. It's the end of Dr. Strangelove.
Mm-hmm.
But if Ramsey's right, then they're not going to launch their missiles, and the missiles are already flying. And again, it's still going to be the end of the world. Hunter, though, has one little piece of business on his side, and that's that they don't go out on these patrols by themselves. There's like a redundancy. So theoretically, there's another sub that should also be sending missiles at the same time. Ramsey says, well, but what if that ship has also been sunk? Like, how do you know? We don't know. We have no information. In the absence of information, we use our last orders, which is to launch those missiles.
Yes.
And then we have a mutiny where they, as they are literally getting the keys ready to launch the missiles.
Which one of these events are you calling the mutiny?
Well, both, as it turns out. Well, okay. So, I guess when XO Hunter relieves the captain of his duty, he is doing it by the book.
Yes.
So he has dotted all the I's and crossed the T's, and including the chief of the boat ends up mm-hmm. siding with him, not because he wants to necessarily, but because it's the right thing.
Exactly.
So they actually arrest the captain, put him away to his barracks.
Yeah, he is relieved of his command.
Yes. So from the captain and his cohort's viewpoint, that's the mutiny. But from the Navy's point of view in their investigation, later when James Gandolfini and his brethren basically break the captain out and arm themselves to take an armed takeover of the bridge, that is also a mutiny.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But before that happens, pretty much right after Ramsey is locked in his quarters, when they're trying to go up to a depth to receive the message, they find that the Russian sub has, the reason they lost it is because it was directly above them.
Yes, and so now they have the real fight.
Yeah, so now Hunter gets some combat experience he wasn't expecting. And he destroys the Russian sub.
And yet, that last torpedo, that pesky last torpedo. By the way, one nuclear sub destroyed another nuclear sub during basically the Cuban Missile Crisis. that's liable to come up later.
Mm-hmm.
Although, again, with diplomacy, I don't know. It's weird. So we have this mutiny thing. We've got resentment from some of the crew. Because really, Hunter doesn't have a lot of friends. I mean, he's got Vigo, who's the weapons commander or something. But that's about it. And even then,
And he's not very happy.
No.
Because he's been telling Hunter that, Ramsey is a hard ass, but he knows what he's doing and he's a good captain and you need to listen to him.
Exactly. So the clock is ticking because, again, they only had an hour to launch these missiles in time to save the world or to preemptively strike the base that has the missiles from the Russian side. So we've got this race where Ramsey is trying to regain control of the ship and Hunter catches wind of it. So he tries to move some pawns around.
Well, this is after that final torpedo from the destroyed sub impacted and damaged Alabama, left it without propulsion, so it was sinking to the bottom of the ocean.
Yes, which would have made it implode.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were all seconds away from dying. Luckily, it's a Bruckheimer film. It's not going to happen like that. It's not Das Boot. So they regain propulsion, but again, they are still have a really damaged radio. And basically the only hope that Hunter has, because, if it turns out no matter what happens, if they end up going back to port, Hunter's going to have a rough time explaining the whole thing. but really, yeah. Obviously, there'll be other problems if he turns out to be wrong. But he has to, you know, we have to confirm that he's right. I mean, that's the whole point. So they have to get the radio repaired and go up surface enough to get the message, like to even receive it, because their antenna is all broken or whatever. And actually, sorry, there when they launch the antenna around the or with the other sub around, that's kind of what causes the whole actual fight to start between the two subs, because the winch that was releasing the antenna to float up toward the surface made noise.
Mm-hmm.
So
stupid winch.
Yeah, that's not a winch. That's my wife. Now we have this tense exchange where Hunter and Ramsey are finally face off. Actually, there's a couple little things because Vigo reluctantly goes along with the gang who breaks the captain out.
I love Vigo Mortensen's voice during this whole thing, because he goes from being like his like commanding presence voice to when they're trying to recruit him, he almost turns into like kind of like Rizzo or something. He's like, "Oh man, come on guys, what are you doing?"
Yes.
Yep. Great work. Great work by Vigo.
Yeah, he's got tension all over his face.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, his other choice? He's gonna fight these guys in a naked sauna? Not this movie, he's not.
Yeah, not yet.
So anyway, there's a little bit of cat and mouse action. And Vigo is ultimately put in a position where, at first, he refuses the direct order of the captain.
Mm-hmm.
Ramsey. It's
Hunter. Hunter gets in his head.
Yes, Hunter gets in his head. Yes, and Hunter has disabled the ability to launch from the control room, so they've got to go down to the missile control room to launch.
Yeah, from the bridge.
Yeah, yeah. So instead, Ramsey goes down and tries to launch from the mission from the weapons control and negotiate with Vigo to like get that shit done, because he tries to tell him over the radio to do it or whatever, but he can't or doesn't. So Ramsey's going to go down and deal with him. Well, in the meantime, that's when Hunter sneaks up, takes the key away from the bridge and blah, blah, blah. But there's a scene where you think that Gene Hackman is going to shoot an innocent sailor. Like, he's not going to shoot the guy refusing to do the order. He's going to shoot a peon sailor who is crying at the time.
Is he crying or is he sweating?
Both. So this is where we it's cemented that, okay, so Ramsey is not a good guy.
No.
At least he didn't shoot the guy, so that was nice.
And if he ever was a good guy, then he is losing his shit.
Yes. And actually, Vigo relents. So he's not going to see his fellow sailor die on his behalf. Gandolfini wants him dead, though. Gandolfini's great as a villain.
He was so punchable.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Because he's just fat enough to be like, oh, you're not even a good sailor.
And he has just such a look of glee on his face when he gets to be an asshole.
Yeah, well, and we see early on that he loves his authority.
Yeah. Yeah, but he's not a commander. He's just a toady.
Exactly. But he wields what rank he has against those who are under him. Anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So he's a great little minor villain. Well, again, standoff where they have a little conversation about Libazon or Stallions. And clearly, this thing is coming to a head, and we end up with a 3-minute countdown to whether or not to launch the missiles, which, you know, I guess Ramsey didn't have to do.
No, but that's the part that felt like a very much like a Tarantino, interlude.
Yes.
Because, I mean, another part of the movie that I think didn't hold up too well is there's so much great tension and cat and mouse. And then it sort of culminates with a scene of one of the leads punching the other one.
Yeah.
That part felt beneath this movie. This movie didn't need two guys punching each other like that.
Yeah.
But like at the height of the tension, at the climax, taking a pause to sit down and just wait and have a relatively cordial chat while the fate of the world hung in the balance, that felt like a very Tarantino touch to me.
Yes. I mean, as much tension as there was in that scene, because they are literally holding guns on each other, the minor cast of characters all have guns drawn or whatever, and as the two captains sit there and talk about horses and wait for the world to end, it does kind of slow things down a little bit and allows Ramsey to seem more reasonable.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, he was not reasonable, because we just saw him nearly shoot a sailor. Well, as you could guess, even if you haven't seen the movie, it turns out Denzel's right. But that's not where the movie ends. It doesn't, click its heels and say, right on! And then Vigo and Denzel do the fist bump, and everybody just electric slides off the boat, and everybody's happy.
Yeah, no, instead it cuts to Jason Robards.
Exactly. Who is great, and he's been through nuclear war, so he knows the Holocaust that is a nuclear attack on America. So they go through a naval tribunal at Naval Station Pearl Harbor. Everybody's dressed in their dress whites, and Gandolfini doesn't have good news given to him. His internal affairs investigation must have come out with sustained complaints. But Jason Robards comes up and splits the baby a little bit. It's like, bad shit happened. Shouldn't have happened. Since we have one, war hero who's agreed to resign, or to retire with honor. And on Ramsey's recommendation, Hunter will be promoted so he can have a new command. But otherwise, let's not talk about this anymore.
Yeah, because you guys broke the Navy.
Yes, exactly. Everybody was wrong. So while both men were right and wrong, the world didn't end. So it, Hunter comes out on top slightly. And of course, the cheesy scene at the end, but just it's great when Gene Hackman finally turns to the end zone and says, you were right. Or I was wrong. Sorry. He didn't say you're right. He says, I was wrong about the Libazoner Stallions, not about anything else. So, and then they click their heels and electric slide down, get the dog and
get the dog, yeah, from the poor, ensign who hold the dog while he was inside the building.
Yeah, the poor guy in the Cracker Jack uniform. So, yeah, I think I said earlier, just my notes here, originally it was going to be the bad computer on aboard the boat. So they wanted to say, it's Hunt for Red October meets 2001. So, but the Navy officer said, yeah, there's no computer on the Trident sub that can launch missiles, so that's implausible. You got to come up with something else. By the way, there's an end card in this movie, and it's supposed to be comforting. It says that, since...
bet it was comforting in 1995.
Yeah, I think it was, yes. So in 1995, this comforting end card says that... there is now regulations that no, because the movie starts with a title card that says the three most powerful people in the world are the United States, President of the United States, the Premier of Russia, or whatever, and a nuclear submarine commander.
Mm-hmm.
Because those are the only three people that can launch missiles. Well, the end card relieves us to say, you know what? This wouldn't really happen because now the rules are a submarine commander cannot be the only one saying to launch the missiles. Instead, it goes that responsibility falls on the commander in chief. Like, oh no! Or sorry, if I was in Ireland, oh no! And also, why am I having a news conference in an airport lounge? Oh, I know, because the President of the United States wanted to do it at his Irish golf course, and I said no. So, that's a little frightening. To think that any leader in the world today can just arbitrarily launch a missile is frightening. I can't think of one I'd want to have trusted with the button right now.
Nope.
Yeah. Oddly, the only thing that comes to mind is Angela Merkel. But, I am old enough to realize that I don't want the Germans involved in this. Sorry, Germans, but, yeah. So... Crimson Tide. I hope Jason remembers this movie fondly, because I'm suggesting that he would give it an A, if not an A+. Because I think it holds up. There's
It really does.
There's a couple of, again, a couple of little tone-deaf moments. But again, it's kind of a period piece. And it's also such a narrow area that, like I said, all of the outdated technology. Again, maybe that's still the same technology today. Because I think just recently, the Navy had to change from Windows XP. Because it was finally not going to be supported by Microsoft. But they didn't want to change. Like, they're like, oh, no.
Yeah, I believe it.
So, you would imagine they go a full Schlumberger and develop their own system. Oh. They probably do have their own systems, actually. For a lot of stuff.
That's even worse.
You will, yeah. Absolutely. I suspect there are still vendors involved. Ugh, the worst. So, yeah. I'm going to give it an A. I'd say an A+. I think this is a movie that you could, if it comes on TV or your streaming service or however you watch movies, I would watch the rest of this movie wherever it started.
Yeah. I mean, was this the last great Gene Hackman role?
Maybe. 95?
I mean, when did he stop making movies?
Oh, it's been a while now. In the 2000s, he was in Heist, which we've talked about.
Oh, Heist.
Again, Heist. Heartbreakers with Sigourney Weaver and Jennifer Love Hewitt. Well, Ray Liotta, too. The Royal Tenenbaums.
Twilight.
Oh, yes. Not
Kristen the vampire Stewart. Movie.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, in the 90s, he was in Get Shorty and The Quick and the Dead and The Birdcage, which I still think is a great movie we'll have to talk about. He was in Unforgiven. His final film was Welcome to Mooseport. But in the 80s, we've got No Way Out. We've got Mississippi Burning. We have Reds, Hoosiers.
One of the most watched movies ever, Superman 2.
yes. Oh, that was in the 70s, though. Oh, no, maybe the 80s was Superman 2.
Superman was in the 70s.
1980 was Superman 2. So, yeah. The Conversation, I still think, is probably, I don't know. I mean, it's certainly a fantastic movie and a fantastic portrayal. But, and I've tried to watch The French Connection several years ago, and I didn't think it held up. Maybe we'll have to watch it for the pod just so it gives us some purpose. Because I've got it. I think I have, like, the Criterion Edition or whatever of it. And that was the thing that made him a leading man. He actually was up for and accepted the role of Mike Brady in The Brady Bunch. But his agent said, no, why, you know, you're better than this. And it turns out he was. Because that's shortly thereafter came The French Connection and he became a leading man. And then he goes to Poseidon Adventure, The Conversation, Young Frankenstein, Bridge Too Far, and of course, Superman, the movie. Yeah, Gene Hackman. He's 89. Someday he's going to appear on the Not in a Creepy Way Facebook page, like Dr. John did today.
Oh, no.
Yeah, pour one out for the good doctor. Yeah, so danced around a little bit. Drew, was it worth it?
Absolutely. This is a top-tier movie. All the performances are fantastic. It's perfectly paced. It's a fun time. It holds up. This is everything you would want in this type of movie. These are all masters at their craft at the top of their game.
It's got compelling action scenes, but at its heart, it's a stage play. It could all take place on the bridge of the ship.
Yeah.
So I think they married that world really good. I mean, they gave a blockbuster turn on, a stage play.
I think Tony Scott is also just continually underrated. In my mind, he doesn't get talked about enough as like one of the great filmmakers ever. But, you know, you look at his filmography and it's, you know, they're not all like, he didn't make like Oscar bait movies, but he made fantastic action/thriller movies. And even the bad ones were still really fun to watch, or at least interesting. Even Revenge, the Kevin Costner movie, that's not a great movie, but that was one that was on TV all the time when I was younger, and it was eminently watchable.
Well, let's just take a trip down Tony Scott Aileen. First of all, there's The Hunger, which is an amazing movie that is actually kind of slower paced than I remember. But it's basically a vampire movie with Susan, a vampire lesbian movie with Susan Sarandon and David Bowie and, oh God, I can't remember her name now. Oh my God. One of the most beautiful actresses ever.
Catherine Deneuve.
Catherine Deneuve. Yes. Great. Great movie. Very, very, very stylish. Super stylish. Almost artsy. That's how, actually not almost, just actually artsy. And then there's of course Top Gun, which is like as blockbuster as you can get. Mm-hmm. Beverly Hills Cop 2, Revenge, Days of Thunder, a movie I've never seen.
Beverly Hills Cop 2 is a great movie.
We should talk about it.
It is a great movie.
Okay. We got to put it on the calendar. We should put it on the calendar with Days of Thunder because I've never seen it, but I quote Rubbin is Racin' all the time.
Yeah, we should definitely watch it before our parents go attend a NASCAR race.
Absolutely. That's a great idea. And then, of course, The Last Boy Scout, which had mixed reviews on the pod, but was still fun.
It was very stylish, too.
Yeah. And then we have True Romance, which I don't think I've ever seen. I know it's really? Like a sin, because, again, Tarantino writing, it's got everybody we like. Never really seen it.
It has James Gandolfini's best performance.
And then we have Crimson Tide. We've got The Fan, right? Is that a Wesley Snipes movie?
Wesley Snipes and Robert De Niro, yeah.
Enemy of the State, of course. And then Spy Game, Man on Fire, Domino. Again, movies we've loved.
Yeah, Man on Fire is probably my favorite Tony Scott movie.
Yeah, and I know Domino's a bad movie, but I love Domino.
Domino was a great movie.
It's just so over the top. And then he did the remake of Taking a Pelham 1-2-3, followed by the remake of The A-Team.
No, he didn't do The A-Team.
Yeah? Oh, no, he didn't direct it, but he produced it. Sorry.
Okay. You skipped over Deja Vu.
Which I don't remember.
It's a wild Denzel Washington movie about time traveling something like 6 minutes into the past.
Oh, okay.
Or being able to see 6 minutes into the future. I don't even remember. It was a pretty forgettable.
Hold on. Denzel Washington, Paula Patton, James Caviezel, Val Kilmer, Adam Goldberg, and Bruce Greenwood. We have to have this movie on our list. We could do a Deja Vu / Fallen double feature.
I think Deja Vu and Unstoppable are sort of in the same vein of pretty good action movies that aren't going to offend you. You're not going to remember much about them, but...
Yeah. Well, and the thing about Unstoppable, not only is it perfectly acceptable train movie, but in the words of comedian Doug Benson, turns out it was stoppable. So Tony Scott, he committed suicide. It's very sad.
Is he the better movie maker of the Scott brothers?
I think he has to be. I think he was probably overshadowed by Ridley earlier, but...
Well, Ridley has an Oscar, right?
Yeah. What does he have an Oscar for?
Gladiator?
Yeah. Okay. So, there we go. Sorry, but, you know, come on. Any of these movies could have been Gladiator sort of material. Although he was nominated for, I don't know, Thelma and Louise, Black Hawk Down... The Martian. Yeah, so he's respectable.
Did he do Blade Runner? Yeah, he directed Blade Runner.
Oh, here we go. So here's the filmography. The Duelists, which I've never seen. Alien, Blade Runner, Legend. Skipping. Black Rain.
Legend.
Thelma and Louise.
Wow.
G.I. Jane. Gladiator, Hannibal. Black Hawk Down. Matchstick Men, which I remember would be actually really good. American Gangster. Skipping. Prometheus. Never seen it. Watch the first like half an hour of it and I fell asleep, I think. Exodus, Gods and Kings, a movie I've almost watched several times. The Martian. I understand there's potatoes and sciencing the shit out of stuff, but haven't seen it.
It's great.
Alien Covenant. So the sequel to Prometheus and the prequel to the Alien movies.
Have you seen it?
Nope. Have you?
Yes.
Is it worth seeing?
It's fine. I just, my biggest question coming out of it was, why does it exist?
Ah. And then All the Money in the World, which I've heard good things about, but I have not seen.
Kevin Spacey is great in that.
Well, we have Michelle Williams, Christopher Plummer, Mark Wahlberg. Oh, that's the movie where Mark Wahlberg got Me Too'd.
Kevin Spacey.
No. Well, Kevin Spacey got kicked out of it because of actual Me Too'd. But you remember the controversy about the...
The paying, getting paid for the reshoots.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Because of all the reshoots needed, Michelle Williams did it for basically like union scale.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Wahlberg got $2 million for it.
Yeah.
Well, 1.5, sorry.
He was like, fuck you, pay me.
Yeah, it was like $1.5 million for Mark Wahlberg, and Williams got paid $80 per diem, which is hilarious. And actually, in the original shooting, Wahlberg got $5 million, while Williams got paid $625,000. Which is a fucking crying shame. I mean, I understand that Mark Wahlberg is a movie star or whatever, but Michelle Williams is fucking a brilliant actor.
Mm-hmm.
So, just because she has a bunch of quirky indie movies, doesn't mean you should pay her like she's a quirky indie actress.
So does Mark Wahlberg. You've seen The Big Hit.
Well, that's a quirky Christina Applegate movie, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know what? I think Tony Scott makes at least as fun movies as Sir Ridley does.
Yeah, if I had to pick an entire filmography that I had to watch, I would pick Tony Scott's.
Yeah, I think it'd be much more fun.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, good stuff. Ridley does good stuff. Let's not...
Yeah.
I mean, the poor guy's doing fine.
Black Hawk Down is great.
Yeah.
I thought it was great. The Martian, great.
Yeah, well, it's hard to beat Matt Damon. So, anything else on Crimson Tide?
No. You should watch it. If you haven't seen it, see it. It's even though it's an, I'm using finger quotes, older movie, you know, what, 25 years old now? It holds up. It's fantastic. Timeless. It's timeless.
Even since we've spoiled it, it doesn't matter. You know where it's going. As soon as there's the question, you know that there's going to be a conflict, and you know where it's going. So I say dive in with both feet. So, housekeeping. Housekeeping. I don't have personal housekeeping this week as much as I've got films I've watched and want to talk about.
Okay.
Do you have housekeeping?
Not too much.
Okay, let's talk about movies.
All right.
Now, you're on, you've, I don't know if you've seen what I've been putting on Letterboxd, but I've done a little bit of watching. I bit the bullet and joined Shudder.
Oh, how do you like it?
There's not as much on it as I thought there would be, but it's got plenty of stuff. It'll keep me busy for a while.
Are you going to talk about Soul Station? Because I saw that. That sounded crazy.
Soul Station is an animated movie that's a prequel to Train to Busan.
See, that sounds awesome. But I read further.
Yeah, it is dark. It's got some, and at first I thought it was just going to be like a lot of like political talk kind of shoved into a zombie movie.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a little bit of that, especially at first, but it's much darker than that. It's a crazy, for an animated movie, it is crazy dark. Maybe I just haven't seen as much animated dark movies as are out there, but this was probably the darkest animated movie I've ever seen.
Was it good?
Yeah, it was worth seeing. It was a little bit long, but it was good. I definitely recommend it.
Did it actually feel like a movie connected to Train to Busan?
It made me want to watch Train to Busan afterward. It lives in the same world, but I don't remember the politics being mentioned a lot in Train to Busan. I'm sure there was class stuff, right?
Not a whole lot.
I want to talk about it. I want you to see it, and we'll talk about it, because it's interesting. And then I watched a movie, and I think Jason has talked about this movie positively. But it's a 1979 horror classic, remastered, actually, that I saw on Shudder, called Phantasm. Do you remember Phantasm?
Yeah, we watched this when I was really little, right?
Yeah, yeah. You know what? It's kind of a perfect kids movie. Kids horror movie, because it's got some horror tropes. It's got some things that could be kind of scary. But it's also sort of tame and batshit crazy. Makes no sense, this movie. And I think I've read that the people who defend the movie as being a classic kind of agree that the whole... I think the premise of the second in the series, which, by the way, you can watch a Phantasm, the original, Phantasm 3, 4, and 5, but you can't watch Phantasm 2 on Shudder, so there must be a rights issue there.
Yeah, wasn't Phantasm 2 the most successful? Wasn't it called Mask of Phantasm or something?
Oh, I don't know, but yeah.
Positive we watched it.
There are so many things in Phantasm, though, that don't... It's like they put a bunch of ideas into a hat and just use them all. It's crazy. I gave it 2 stars because enthusiasm. The story is just, it's just a complete mess. So, and then I watched some other docs. I watched, Children of God, which is a cult documentary. And then I watched Heaven's Gate, The Untold Story, another cult documentary. I was into cults for a bit. Because, so, you know, not all cults are equal, but all cults are kind of simple, or similar, rather. Charismatic leader. There is a podcast that, because I looked at some cult podcasts too, and there is a cult podcast I can't remember the name of, that actually does the Pilgrim Family. But
oh.
I'm not going to watch it. I'm not going to listen to it. Can't do it. I don't think it will make me a better person to listen to it. Because, again, I've never met any of the Pilgrim family, but our parents certainly have, and still correspond with them. Yeah, it's too much of real people. Anything else on your housekeeping?
Yes, I have a couple movies that I watched. Oh, please. I rewatched Ronin. Do you remember the movie Ronin with Robert De Niro?
You know what? That is a movie that I saw maybe 7/8 of. Because I think we taped it on a videotape and it ran out. I never got to see the end. Or maybe we had to return the video before I got to see the end of it for some reason.
That's funny. I remember really liking Ronin when it first came out. It's a 1998 movie. It has some really fantastic car chases. And I was a little underwhelmed by it. Watching it again, I was a little bummed out. There's still some really good stuff in it, but overall, it was really hard for it to keep my attention. No, it was definitely no Crimson Tide. But for some reason, I watched that, and sort of separately, Netflix recommended a movie to me, and you know the Netflix algorithm can be really surprising.
Yeah. Kind of random.
Yeah. Yeah. Sort of like if I were to describe it in terms of my former profession, it's like a systematic grid based on a random start.
Okay. Sure.
So I mean there's some logic to it, but it starts out unpredictably. And then just goes from there. But it had been recommending this movie to me for a while. And I finally pulled the trigger on watching it. It's called Message from the King, which was turned out not to be the movie I was expecting. It was okay. It was decent. I'm glad I watched it. But there is a scene in the movie where the main character says the title of the movie. And it is a... I cannot describe how unintentionally funny that scene is in a movie that is like this really like dark contemporary noir movie. Chadwick Boseman is the main guy. Jacob King is his name.
Okay.
But it's got Alfred Molina is in it, and he's
Freddy.
Yeah, I think Alfred Molina is playing the same character he played in Boogie Nights.
Have you ever heard an interview with Alfred Molina?
I can't say that I have.
He was on Never Not Funny a couple weeks ago. Yeah, maybe a couple months ago, actually. First of all, they call him Freddy. Never occurred to me he'd be a Freddy.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay.
And he is hilarious. And, you know, one of his first movie roles was in Raiders of the Lost Ark, where they put spiders in his mouth.
Oh.
Yeah, it's he was Indy's friend in the very beginning. So, yeah, he's hilarious. He's sort of a raconteur.
So, Message from the King. It was fine. I wouldn't recommend it if you have other stuff to watch. But if you're doing laundry or something, it's fine.
Okay.
I watched Captain Marvel.
Oh, yeah. How was that?
I liked it quite a bit. Annette Bening is in it. That surprised me.
She's great. Does she tell anybody to jerk their own soda?
No. But yeah, it was good. I mean, it's not groundbreaking. It's pretty standard, but it's fun. I think Brie Larson does a good job embodying that character from the comic books.
I see. I'm not familiar with that character at all.
She has a really weird. I mean, you're familiar with the character Rogue?
Yes.
Do you remember what Rogue's powers were?
Yeah, she got to take on other people's powers.
Yes, and at some point, she permanently stole somebody's powers and kind of their psyche.
Is that Jean Grey?
It was Carol Danvers.
Oh, Carol Danvers, okay.
Yeah, as when she was Miss Marvel.
Ah, okay.
So, yeah, so she's been around for a while, but she was always very very quippy. At some points, she was a spy. At other points, she was an Air Force pilot. And she's had various superpowers throughout the comic book history, but always kind of X-Men adjacent.
Okay.
But so I've always liked her. She was a superhero called Binary at some point when she became a human embodiment of a star.
Okay. Which is what she is in this movie?
No. In this movie, she's
like super powerful, right?
Yes, she's the most powerful superhero on Earth.
Ah, okay.
Maybe the galaxy.
Ah.
But the movie was fun. It's got Jude Law in it. It's got Ben Mendelsohn in it.
Sold.
It's got a de-aged Sam Jackson in it, who looks great. Like, the de-aging they did on him looked really good.
You know, we're going to talk about Glass in a month or so. And Sam Jackson, when Sam Jackson is toned down a little bit, when he's reined in, he's still really good. He's just a good actor.
He has really good comedic timing, too.
Yeah, and ask him, he'll tell you.
Yeah. I also watched The Girl in the Spider's Web.
Yeah, I saw that a couple weeks ago. What did you think?
I thought Claire Foy was really good. And I found the movie to be almost entirely impenetrable. Like, I didn't feel like I was watching a story.
I thought it was, well, because I've always thought those movies were maybe overly complicated, or there's just, I mean, even from the very first one, no matter which one you watch, the Fincher version or the Norwegian version, because I really like Naomi Rapace, I think is how you pronounce her name, something, it's how you spell her name. I think she's great in those movies, especially because she's just attractive enough that she's a movie star, but she's also plain enough to carry on these like grittier roles, if that makes sense. Maybe I'm demeaning her talent. So I thought Claire Foy was a little bit prettier even than Rooney Mara, because they made up Rooney Mara to look pretty scary in the Fincher movie. But I don't know. I just thought it was sort of second rate. Like, it was pretty. I mean, it was beautiful. Again, with things shot on digital, I think it's difficult. Unless you really see the seams, I think it's easier to make a prettier movie than it used to be.
Yeah. I mean, the Dragon Tattoo movies, at their heart, they're still a mystery.
Yeah, true.
And this movie was more like a really watered down Mission Impossible movie.
Kind of. More like almost a superhero movie. Superhero versus supervillain.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Kind of a, yeah, like a Batman.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. They're trying to turn Elizabeth Salander into Batman.
Yeah.
And yeah, it just, it wasn't interesting.
Turns out I have very complicated feelings about Batman that I have yet to get out on paper.
Well, I can't wait.
Yeah, you'll be the first to know.
Yeah, but yeah, that's about what I've been watching. I've also been rewatching Deadwood.
Oh yeah, in anticipation of the film.
Yeah, the movie's out. Oh. I haven't watched it yet.
I want to see Godzilla King of the Monsters because I really like the MonsterVerse movies. Again, I backed into it because of Skull Island, which I liked a lot.
Watch the first Godzilla movie?
I did. After I watched it at first, and that was meh. And then I watched Skull Island and saw it was all part of the same piece. And then I rewatched Godzilla again and got a little more appreciation out of it.
Nice.
So, yeah. And then I watched Shin Godzilla, which is a horrible movie. An actual, like, Japanese Godzilla movie.
With men in rubber suits, right?
Yes, yes. Not good.
Turns out, good?
Yeah, you know, I think I told you, before Skull Island, I don't think I'd seen a King Kong movie I actually enjoyed. I mean, I admire claymation and whatnot. And so it was a classic movie monster, great, you know, whatever. But, you know, some of those classic movies I don't actually appreciate either. Like, I don't really like Bela Lugosi's Dracula. Like, the Todd Browning film? Just, eh. And, you know, the Frankenstein is fine. Bride of Frankenstein is better. Invisible Man is horrible. The Fly is actually a lot funnier and comic booky, although it's really dark in the beginning of it. Otherwise, it's kind of a silly movie with lots of, I mean, as soon as they get into rabbits, it's like, what? That's why the Cronenberg movie is so much scarier and grosser. Cronenberg is another one. That's, we got to dig further into him because he's a weirdo.
Wasn't it a cat in the Cronenberg movie?
I think so, yeah. But let me tell you, in the original movie, it's a Vincent Price movie that Vincent Price is like the fifth character or something. He's not even an important character until the second movie. But the rabbit thing is crazy. I mean, I hadn't even remembered the thing about the rabbits. It's like, it's silly. All I remember is the hydraulic. Remember I had a Scholastic book I bought at a book fair about classic movie monsters? And they had a photo that had the doctor from The Fly. You see his body because he has crushed his head and his arm in the industrial press. So it's very stark. Lasting thing way before I saw the movie. So my mind built a much scarier movie than it turned out to have been. Anyway, I'm all ranting off on movie. And, you know, this whole visit through Friday the 13th movies and listening to In Voorhees We Trust with Gourley and Rust. Man, those Friday the 13th movies are, some of them are bad. Even the ones that I found enjoyable are just, frankly, just not great. Like, I think part 6 is my favorite because it's got the Alice Cooper song in it. And it's got, what, Ron Palillo, Horshack, the very beginning. But, man, by the time they get
to... You mean the classic Alice Cooper banger, He's Back?
Yes. But then there's a Jason Takes Manhattan is maybe the worst, although Jason Goes to Hell is maybe a close second. And then Freddy vs. Jason is fine. And, you know, Friday the 13th 1 and 2 are fine. And the Corey Feldman angle is silly, but it's kind of like at that point it was a sort of a formula that worked. Like 3 and 4 are formulas that worked. 5 is kind of lacking. And then, five was super lacking because Jason's not even in it. 6 was the Alice Cooper one. 7 and 8.
Wait, what happens in 5 if Jason isn't in it?
Here's the history of Jason. So in the first movie, Jason's not the killer. It's Jason's mom.
All right.
Jason just appears at the end. By the way, looking like some sort of like he has some severe deformity. Even though they show him in flashbacks, he's not deformed at all. So if you really look at that, it's like, well, did that all happen underwater when he was like a frog boy or whatever? Or whatever. And then in the second movie, you've got an even better final girl. And it's great. it's where Jason really becomes Jason, although he doesn't have the mask yet. Three is in 3D, and that's where he comes up with the mask. It's really campy, but, you know, it's a thing, and it was on a lot when I was a kid, so we saw it a ton.
So he doesn't have the mask. Do they just never show his face?
He has, like, a bag with one eye cut out of it for his eye.
Okay. I don't remember that at all.
By the way, LeBron James, like, has now, I think he owns part of the franchise. He got the rights to it. Because they had this whole, like, James Bond-style rights dispute where the initial writer gets the name Jason, the name Friday the 13th, but not the mask, not the machete. Like, it's crazy. It's like, it's weird. So, anyway, so then four is Tommy Jarvis, who is Corey Feldman as a young kid. Five is Tommy Jarvis as an older kid who is now in an insane asylum or whatever, or in a group home or whatever, and somehow knows karate and is fighting Jason, but it's not Jason. It's really the ambulance attendant whose son was a fat guy in the camp that got killed like in the very first attack.
This sounds very Santa Barbara-y.
It's the worst. Yeah. So then we have the Alice Cooper one where he gets resurrected by lightning, like Ron Palillo. They want to dig him up, and of course it's during a thunderstorm, blah blah blah. It's actually Jason has a little bit more like physicality. It may have been Kane Hodder's first Jason, I don't know. But it turns out Jason, the Jason character, has never been, until like Kane Hodder got involved and tried to do some like acting behind the mask. Really, like once a movie or twice a movie, he just jumps through a window for no reason, and he crashes through doors and stuff. It wasn't until like four or five where there's actually children, like it's a kids camp and everything. Like, ah, scary. But then we have Jason Takes Manhattan, which mostly takes place aboard a boat. Like, because apparently a Crystal Lake goes right into the ocean and goes all the way up the East Coast. So that's ridiculous. So many plot holes and things that don't make any sense, that it's just no excuse for it. It makes me appreciate Nightmare on Elm Street movies. I mean, they're also sometimes not great, but at least they are a lot more fun. Because like the Halloween movies had a really kind of bad period too. Yep. Anyway, so yeah, I've seen a lot of schlocky movies, and makes Crimson Tide even better. Like the fact that Crimson Tide, I'm telling you, this could be my Sunday night movie forever.
Completely rewatchable.
Yeah, I think so. So take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here. Take a listen if you got a second to bear. If you like, subscribe, you can even share. Films on films, discuss on air. It's a brother podcast, we're gonna leave it right here. One podcast talk show. Hit the app if you wanna catch an episode. They talk movies, they go off on a tangent flow and maybe ramble. That's a brother Sanderson. So sit back with closed eyes, let them take you away. Unless you're driving, keep them open in that case. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother Jay. Welcome you to Not in a Creepy Way. Hey. Not in a creepy way. 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 Okay. Not in a creepy way. Not in a creepy way. We got Eric, Drew, and Brother.